Ground Cover News is a nonprofit street paper that was founded in April 2010 as a means to empower low-income persons to make the transitions from homeless to housed and from jobless to employed. Vendors purchase each copy of the Ground Cover News regular edition at our office for 50 cents. This money goes towards production costs. Vendors work selling the paper on the street for $2, keeping all income and tips from each sale. This audio production was made possible by the Ann Arbor District Library, recorded at Fifth Avenue Studios. If you consistently enjoy Ground Cover Speaks, continuing to buy physical newspapers from Ground Cover vendors ensures that we can sustain production. The physical paper and in-person interaction is at the heart of our work. You can find the link to our next audio recording in the upcoming print issue of Ground Cover News. Thanks for listening.
Special thanks to our print advertisers, the People's Food Co-op, St. Francis of Assisi Parish, First Baptist Church, Bethlehem United Church of Christ, the Office of Community and Economic Development, Cineholic, Art on a Journey, Ann Arbor for Public Power, Four Directions, and the Ypsilanti Food Co-op.
Joyful in the month of January. January is one of the most challenging months of the year, but January can also be enjoyable. In January, you can do a lot of self-care for yourself and can do a lot of care for others too. You can buy something nice and good for your friends and family. You can also make snacks and goodies for your family. Similar to during the holidays, you can write loving cards to your friends. And you can do self-care like decorating and baking things for yourself and others. In the month of January, focus on other goals that you set for the new year, even if it's having a better attitude toward life and people. I like to listen to old folk music and old music from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I like to be with friends and do staycations at home. I like to watch movies and be with the people who I trust. It's also good to have a staycation at home with the ones you love or just yourself. I feel sorry for people who don't have a place to be. I wish I could be someone's friend who doesn't have a place and to be and share things with them, but the world is not that easy and trusting, so I can't easily do that. I wish there was a way to comfort a friend and be a friend to people who are down. I also like to be a good friend all year round, not just during the winter months. We would stick together and go out to movies and watch movies together. These are the joys of January I can think of right now. Other than that, January can be an early Valentine's Day.
No way home. Standing on the corner, I'm not invisible. I notice how you cross over to the other side to avoid me. Those of you brave enough to walk by me as you approach are expecting me to ask you for something. You see the situation before you. I'm holding this smile and a newspaper. Don't be a snooby, a person who looks down on others. You assume the worst because you don't know my story. However, along with being a hard worker, I have always been a generous, kind, loving, and easygoing person. That's why I was taken advantage of. I thrust myself into writing because it's the only thing that can't hurt or be taken from me. Growing up in Detroit, my mother always told me how my father was abusive to her. At the age of 4, I was told to go upstairs and hide. I was not the hiding type. I stood there and watched when my father broke into the house and was swinging a hammer at my mother's lover. She was at the top of the stairs with me. I remember her tossing a gun to her lover. He caught the gun and emptied it on my father. That left me not knowing one side of my whole family. I blocked the memory, however. I often had a recurring dream about the house on Cadillac Street. She married Carl, the lover. He was very abusive to me and my 2 brothers. He knew my sister had a different father. My mother was quite the lying cheater as far as her marriage vows. Carl never abused my sister. I grew up believing what my mother declared to be the truth about my dad. As a child, you believe in your parent or parents. You're naive, expecting to be guided correctly. I've always felt a void, longing for a close-knit family. At 21, I had a baby, the first grandchild in the family. I always told my mother we were supposed to be loving and good to each other, considering we have less than 100 family members. Trusting your mother is a risky thing these days. You would never expect your mother and sister to be part of a church cult. It's painful for me to express. However, it must be told. Raping and trafficking your own grandchild. Even having him hypnotized, thinking he would never remember what happened to him. It probably would have worked if only she would have left him alone. Fortunately for us, a guilty conscience never rests. In 2014, my son was shot 4 times in his back with a .22 caliber gun. My mother and the church cult were hoping to silence him. I thank God he made it through. Relocating from Florida, where we live, was my first experience of being homelessness. My state of mind was fragile. I did not have anyone who I could talk to or trust. I was shattered and felt alone. This was my only child fighting for his life. My family showed up at the hospital pretending to care, only checking to see if he was going to pass. Who could I trust, considering my mother had just called me on that Monday before my child was shot and warned me that my child would be shot? I had to be strong for my child and my grandson, never letting them see me cry, holding back all the tears, squinting through all the fear. The final nails that were supposed to annihilate and destroy me and my family occurred in 2022. My sister invited us over for the 4th of July. They set us up. My only sister and her husband knew that their nephew, my son, is transgender and was still healing from the last episode in his life. They gender bashed him and threatened to kill him and his son, my grandson. Even our relatives would not tell the police the truth. My sister pressed charges against my son for pulling his gun and holding it up in the air after her husband threatened to kill him and his son. She stated to the police that she wanted to help him. We have been scraping constantly, dodging all the crap thrown at us by the state, taking his Social Security away for 2 years without any explanation and constantly denying his appeal. We had to move from state to state trying to find help, all with no family support. My cousins insult me, calling me dumb. Several have said to me, "Don't worry, when you find out, you're going to kill them." Now I know why. I was too blind to see what my mother and my sister were doing all along. I have always believed and said Time tells everything, so you better be good because time will tell on you. Pray for us. It's going to be a battle.
People in the Neighborhood, Nate's Story, by Jim Clark, Ground Cover Vendor, number 139. In an article titled Engaging the Homeless Paranoid Patient on the National Library of Medicine website, it is reported that an estimated percentage of homelessness caused by mental illness, particularly schizoaffective paranoia, is around 23%. People with this disorder are distrusting of the medical community for their own reasons, but one common and very real reason they don't like the healthcare system is because of forced medications. Nate is a 6'6" white male in his mid-40s. He was diagnosed with bipolar manic depression and schizophrenia at the age of 15. Currently homeless, Nate has made a life of managing his mental health and surviving his condition. Nate started his story. People think I'm intimidating, but I'm a really nice, gentle guy. I moved to Dexter, Michigan with my family in 1986 from Austin, Texas, where I was born. My father was really abusive, so I moved to Ann Arbor to live with my mother at the age of 12. Nate is the second oldest of two brothers and has two younger sisters. He has a dog, Cash, whom he loves and who keeps him honest. I asked, "How did you become homeless?" Nate answered, "I've been on SSI since just out of high school and have been homeless off and on ever since. My mental illness makes it hard to stay in one place. I'm staying in shelters and day centers right now. The last time I became homeless was recently. I was calling the police about some issues I was having, but they said I was just being paranoid. As a result, I was arrested, and that's when the court decided community mental health needed to intervene. That intervention resulted in Nate losing his apartment. How is your medication being managed?" I asked. Nate replied, "I've been on medication for the last 15 years. Community mental health stripped me of the medications I was on and started over, which is just mind-boggling." I asked, "Was this court ordered?" "Yes," Nate said. "They took away the medications that were working, which only made my paranoia worse. Now they are trying to build me back up on a new medication. It's been over a year now. I've been telling them for months that I have depression and need help. They just recently put me on Wellbutrin, an antidepressant, which was about a month ago. Meanwhile, all they had me on was an injection and a sleeping pill." "Tell me about the injection," I continued. "It was a medication they introduced to me and asked if I would take it. I can't remember precisely if I was yay or nay, but it didn't sound good. The CMH worker said I was mandated by the court to do what they say to do, so I was going to get the shot. I was pissed about it, and rightfully so. I am the best advocate I can be with my other doctors. We had good medications, and they took that away," he replied. I asked Nate if the injection was forced on him. He said, "Yes." And then I asked, "What happened next?" I asked the CMH worker to look up the Invega shot, and she told me a lot of bad things about it. Nate said, "She said I might have to be hospitalized. There are permanent things that can happen if one is not taken off carefully. I've gained a lot of weight, more than 40 pounds since they started injecting me. The court won't let me off it, but I'm told I'm getting an apartment soon. So I'm hoping by showing them I'm paying bills and staying sober and not calling the police, they will see I'm doing better and reconsider." Finally, I asked, "If you were handed a golden opportunity, what would it be?" "To have better health care." I added, "If you could have a free ride to college, what would you study?" Nate's answer was, "I would like to get a degree in cybersecurity."
NIRA puts $1 million aside to brace for Trump's administration change, but will it be enough? Written by Mike Jones. Ground Cover News Vendor 113, and Anna Gersh, Board President. On December 16, 2024, Ann Arbor City Council voted 9-1 to pass a contingency fund of $1 million to prepare for President-elect Donald J. Trump's coming administration. On January 20th, 2025, Donald J. Trump was sworn into office. Concerned citizens and those at local and state governments are waiting to see what he will do concerning many issues. On January 21st, we already started getting answers. He pardoned those who were convicted in the January 6th insurrection. He has put a freeze on immigration and has signed a collection of executive orders, some of which have already triggered legal pushback. Americans and individuals around the world are worried about these, as well as other actions, including pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement again and the World Health Organization. Trump has been saying what he will and will not do throughout his campaign. He pledged mass deportation of immigrants, steep cuts to education and other departments. He created a Department of Government Efficiency, a presidential advisory committee to help him select as many opportunities as possible to cut spending, although we believe he is still making plans to continue to cutting taxes for the super wealthy and bloated corporations who have made record profits in recent years. Former President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders have warned of excessive secessions to the rich like Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Jeff Bezos. They've warned of the world where the super wealthy will have greater influence on government in the United States. This was transparent. New World Order was in full display at the inauguration, where the billionaire stood in dais with the incoming president and his family. As a result of uncertainty about federal funding for local human services, Ann Arbor City Council has voted 9-1 to actively prepare for President Trump, but will it be enough? This $1 million was set aside and taken from the $2.8 million that was approved by City Council from the general fund reserves. This $2.8 million was to be used for many planned projects, including strengthening our energy alternatives, public safety support, parking subsidies for the city employees, and improvement to the James L. Crawford Elks Lodge, one of the city's bicentennial legacy projects. City Administrator Milton Nohani said at the city council meeting, "The part of the reason for waiting this set aside is that we feel the need to be proactive in this instance. We're talking about a coming uncertainty. We don't know the speed in which it will come. Anything can happen." Ground Cover News reached out to the city administrators for an interview to discuss both the limitations and the goals of such allocations. Mr. Dohani responded personally but declined an interview, stating that without knowing the sort of requests might be made on the funds, he wasn't prepared to guess how this $1 million might actually be spent. Ann Arbor Mayor Christopher Taylor, lacking details, said funds could be used in a multiple of ways, like immigration and city projects. He also went on to say the city is seeing a surplus in the funds due to property taxes coming in above budget amount and more money coming in from marijuana businesses. With extra money, the city has voted to invest in city projects and city employee pay, and now this set aside can help us address potential emergency funding. We have put aside $1 million so that we are able to be responsive to the needs of our residents in the event that the directorality from the federal government changes quickly, the mayor said. Ann Arbor Councilwoman Jean Ear says that all Democratic city councils is trying to be proactive and there's no underlying political motive. "We decided to hit the streets and see how the residents of Ann Arbor were feeling about the $1 million reserve. We started at the heart of the city, 5th and Liberty, found a good spot out of the wind and asked passersby if they mind sharing their thought on the actions with our readers. Here's what they had to say. Bradley said, "I voted for Trump this time. I think he was making a lot more sense. Am I nervous he'll make a lot of cuts? If we voted for him, if we voted him in, that's the best we can do." John said, "That's insane. A lot of people come here to Ann Arbor for help. Ann Arbor does a lot more than a lot of places. And I think the sentiment is great, but if there's a real need, it won't be enough." Sophia said, "I guess I don't know enough about it to have an opinion. I want to know what the city plans to do with that money." Greg said, "It's a great gesture, but it's just a drop in the bucket."
Warning: Homeless People at Work by Elka Chamberlain, ground cover contributor. My January writing assignment was simply working while homeless. The vagueness of this prompt was exacerbated by the fact that I immediately began bubbling ideas and angles reflective of my work and life experiences with homelessness. As I began talking to people, I quickly found myself feeling overwhelmed with all of the important intertwined issues needing to be covered. To develop the story, I reviewed published information about the intersectionality of homelessness and employment, spoke with dozens of people about their working while homeless experiences, and then pounded the pavement to follow up on leads based on community members' input and federal guidelines in the literature. I found there is the need to address the stigma that homeless people are lazy, don't want to work, or should try harder, as well as the need to dispel the myth that having enough income or resources automatically equates to housing stability and a better quality of life. To begin the process of contradicting the stereotype that homeless people are lazy, don't work, and need to try harder, I present three significant findings. First, according to a 2021 article published by the University of Chicago, 53% of the sheltered homeless surveyed had at least some form of formal employment within the year, and 40.4% of the sheltered surveyed had formal income sources. The second statistic, found on a HUD-stamped fact sheet about the Workforce Innovation and Opportunities Act of 2014, states as many as 90% of homeless people want to work. Thirdly, everyone I spoke to this month either does have some sort of income, has had some sort of income over the past year, or is working towards increasing their income, with half deriving that income from paid employment. Part of my journey with researching this topic was recognizing that some of the current research is based on biased, out-of-date sources. Research available for free from the University of Chicago claims most homeless-related studies are heavily dependent on data that is local, outdated, self-reported, and/or taken from government sources such as the U.S. Census, the point-in-time count, and other safety net statistics. When considering how to share the results of currently vulnerable community members' experiences with working while homeless, I had to make difficult decisions related to how to retell their stories. After my pavement experience, which included traumatic interactions with the Veterans Administration, Shelter Association of Washtenaw County, Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, Social Security Administration, and Michigan Works, I found myself in tears, buying $8 eggs, reading the contents of a fresh spinach box bought at a bridge card discount, and pondering when silicone and natural flavoring became curry ingredients. I woke the next morning to a scattering of multiple unworking stoves, frozen water, and a non-functional buddy heater. I decided to refer to my direct resources as buddy in an effort to help honor anonymity requests. When struggling with how to organize community members' feedback related to employment, I considered the MDHHS Housing and Homeless Services link, which claims they work to make homelessness rare, brief, and one-time, with the goal of moving them, individuals and families, into stable housing as quickly as possible and providing the supports needed to achieve permanent housing stability. Despite the division's goal, overall homelessness is increasing, available community supports are not sufficient, and the community's overall housing stability is declining. One of the myths about homeless people is that they don't have enough money, and therefore they need more job skills. To dispel the myth that it is always true that people experiencing homelessness have a need to increase their job skills, consider that some buddies who reported only one episode of homelessness reported that it was during a transitional phase to completing further education. While opportunity for education and skills training may be a great option for some, unfortunately, many employment programs are for specific groups, such as youth, people with disabilities, and veterans. A recent visit to the Michigan Works office was somewhat disappointing. When this writer asked the only worker visible about employment support for the homeless, the only result was a pile of flyers for jobs, including the Wayne County Sheriff's Office, University of Michigan Health System, and Kroger, all of which are places many homeless people are already ineligible for because of mandatory background checks that reveal past involvement with the carceral system. Despite the existence of employment opportunities, several factors were described as barriers to obtaining employment. Many people described multiple forms of discrimination. For example, the discrimination is based on sharing the same address known to be utilized by homeless people. One buddy explained that they knew they were being discriminated against because when they tried an alternate address, they started seeing callbacks immediately. Transportation is another barrier, as it is often necessary to travel for both training programs and higher-paying employment. While there may be potential for support to address transportation needs, these processes often take longer than employers are willing to wait. A buddy shared that they are currently unable to repair their vehicle, which is impacting their training schedule. One buddy shared an experience where they rented a car for work, expecting the cost of the car would be offset by travel reimbursements, only to not earn enough money to cover anything. This led to an eviction. Another buddy explained if they had a vehicle, they would easily be able to get a job in maintenance, earning at least a living wage, but the need to travel beyond public transportation service areas and after hours is prohibitive for them. A major challenge shared by several people was a lack of telephone and or internet to apply for jobs and communicate with prospective employers. Not having access to a consistent phone or internet service also makes navigation more difficult and time-consuming. While there is a potential to obtain a government phone, that process presents such barriers as requiring access to technology, identification, proof of eligibility, a shipping address or email, or a person has to be lucky enough to run into one of the people distributing phones out of their trunk. Another challenge is a lot of jobs won't allow you to apply without government ID, or will insist on original copies of IDs before starting employment. One buddy complained that they couldn't cash checks easily because ID is required to start a bank account. It is a challenge that if you lose your ID or it gets damaged or stolen, there is a cost to get it replaced. Low wages and underemployment are frequently cited as causes for homelessness. Shockingly, of the people I surveyed, not a single homeless person was working at a job earning minimum wage. Some examples of current or recent hourly wages were $15 on the lower end at Burger King, Shelter Association, and Fed Up employees reported earning approximately the local living wage at around $19 an hour, and hourly wages were reported as high as $23 at We the People Opportunity Farm. As of December 2, 2024, MISHTA's Washtenaw County payment standard for a one-bedroom is valued at $1,357 and a two-bedroom at $1,618. An individual working full-time at $23 could afford to find a one-bedroom and qualify based on income, and someone working full-time at $15 could share a two-bedroom or find a studio. Unfortunately, most with formal income reported not being offered enough work hours to be considered full-time. Another disappointing realization made during the process of talking with the buddies was that many people who are eligible for SOAR, SSI, SSDI, Outreach, Access, and Recovery, are not even fully linked to services. SOAR is a special expedited process to apply for Social Security benefits only available to those experiencing or at risk of homelessness who have a serious mental illness, medical impairment, and/or co-occurring substance use disorder. One buddy shared that they had received benefits since the age of 12, yet they went to prison for a crime they didn't commit, and since being released have been without any financial means. At this time, this person has recently started the process of getting linked to services through community mental health. While not everyone with a substance use disorder and/or mental diagnosis qualifies for SOAR, some buddies do attribute homelessness and lack of employment to not being supported during a time of crisis. Another buddy who was recently approved for SSI or SSDI reported he had hired a lawyer to help and it still took years. Some buddies who are employed fall under the category of gig workers. This category refers to those who may have some income, but they are likely working for cash or at least don't get a taxable paycheck. In this category, some buddies report sex work, selling drugs, mowing lawns, snow removal, or hard labor. Some buddies reported door dashing or using their trucks for odd hauling. However, both of the individuals do not have any running vehicles at the moment for Uber or Lyft. One buddy shared they donate plasma, explaining there are two companies in the community, Octapharma and BioLife, that have a twice-weekly donation schedule and earn about $60 each time they donate. The challenge with donating plasma is donation requires identification, an address, which cannot be a homeless shelter, and it may cost up to $4 to access deposits at an ATM. I would like to thank the dozens of people I spoke with this month about their working while homeless experiences. I wish I had enough space to include more of the dialogue and will continue to carry the memories from our discussions. As a working homeless person, I would like to express my gratitude to my local support network, which allows me to wash laundry twice a week, shower daily, get propane to keep me warm, and have options to cook allergy-friendly foods. Thanks also to the community of my alma mater, Eastern Michigan University, who helped me achieve my undergraduate dream of practicing social work from the comfort of my tent with a classic car parked near it.
I hereby resolve by Ken Parks, ground cover vendor 490. When asked about my New Year's resolutions, I replied, to finish what I started. I'm not talking about the end of my life, though I am getting closer. There are projects I want to finish before I die, and finishing my autobiography is the big one. I got as far as the sixth grade and have some 70 years to go. Since my birthday is the day of Che, October 8th is a double celebration. On my 80th, a good number of us watched Finally Got the News at the State Theater. And on my 82nd, a smaller number watched Salt of the Earth at the Friends Meeting House. For October 8th, 2025, I hope to watch The Motorcycle Diaries with you as part of the celebration. In words of Che, we are realists, we dream the impossible. And at the risk of sounding ridiculous, it must be said that the true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. I think you will love this film. Robert Redford affirmed the importance of the original language to get the feel of the story and good subtitles for the meaning of the spoken word. It's an artistic treat. This will be another potluck social, probably the Sunday before or after October 8th, and I hope to have good news on the progress of the autobiography as well as a shared sound system so everyone can hear. Washtenaw Community College said they have no classes for that, but do have systems available for students. They recommended I work with my hearing aid smartphone and an app, so it's off to the hearing aid technicians. Meanwhile, my life's work continues. Maybe we will have a greenhouse hostel as a model for tiny houses in the context of the accessory dwelling units ordinance. City Planning Commission members were at the ground cover office and we discussed the inclusion of permaculture design into the permit and inspection protocol. This process needs follow through. If we learn composting to deal with all of our waste, it will revolutionize wastewater treatment. Our base camp on Carrizo Comecrudo land in Texas used wood shavings as the first step in our bathroom bucket. It was odorless and the first step in composting human fecal waste. These are the changes that Mother Earth will welcome as we learn the lessons of climate chaos and create an interactive, friendly environment for ourselves and all sentient beings. Taking responsibility for the results of our actions is the big challenge we face. If we engage in the struggle for freedom, the stages of the path will promote our creative labor to work on the transformation of our lives. We will learn to move the money from war to meeting human needs. Discovering who we are will be a grand learning experiment. The importance of our bodies will be welcomed as we learn to heal and prepare for a timely death when that time comes. Untimely death will be with us for some time, so ongoing prayer for those surprised by death will help us in this collective transition, which of course has individual experience at its heart. To be fully present, you have to do it yourself, but you don't do it alone. Those of us experiencing aging in its last stages will be welcomed as we learn to embrace life without the denial of death. It will be okay to die with celebration at this new kind of birthday party. When we experience life and death as a seamless whole, our awareness will be on the path to full and complete awakening. Writing about these matters steps beyond our ability to think. Our understanding of the nature of the mind is in a collective gridlock due to the obstacles that are encouraged by a culture of control through a chain of command with which you must be in compliance or face the death penalty. I learned much from Mumia Abu-Jamal's book, Live from Death Row, is a classic of prison literature. Prison radio will deepen your educational experience. Keep in tune with the Prisoner Creative Arts Project. The University of Michigan promotes this exhibit, which I hope will feature art from Guantanamo and Israeli prisons. I had the great honor of giving my copy of Mumia's most famous book to Asada Shakur, black freedom fighter and auntie of Tupac. When the Pastors for Peace caravan into Cuba met with her in the 1990s, her presence is deeply empowering. I hope we all can share something about our resolutions for 2025. Many of us want peace with justice in our time. How are we doing? Health is the issue of our day. Physical and mental health run hand in hand. When both do well, peace will be that much closer. Dr. Jack Cruz's advice on sunlight and reducing blue light stress is a good place to start. He has an excellent post at his own podcast, Sun Education. Learn about heteroplasmy, charge density, and the light choices you make. It will improve mitochondrial function, that is, energy production. Let us tune into the simple living that promotes health. Feed your mind the awareness that arises with the natural breath. Find the teachers who help you reach the next level of awakening. They are ready for you. One of them, Ernest Becker, wrote The Denial of Death and Escape from Evil. His intellectual honesty and clarity will open your mind to the possibility of science as a lifestyle. Facing reality and embracing our power will be a big change. The invention is happening now.
Celebrating the Career of Recovery Visionary Glenys Anderson by Jonathan Glass. What do you get when you combine a single mom of two young children, nearly no resources, and a recently beaten use disorder? If your heart is in the right place and you're willing to do the work, you can get anything you set your mind to. Glenys Anderson beat insurmountable odds to have the effect of a tidal wave, wiping out substance use disorders, mental illness, and destigmatizing those society has marginalized. This month, Anderson is retiring from her CEO role at Home New Vision, a multi-million-dollar nonprofit agency she founded that services Washtenaw and Jackson counties. This is her story. When you tell the story of a woman like Glenys Anderson, it's not just her story you tell. You tell the stories of the million people she helped. While helping a million people may seem like hyperbole, it's probably a bit modest. A little of Glenys lives in every life she's touched, directly or indirectly. The old Gaelic blessing, may the devil not know you're dead until 100 years after you die, can be modified to, May the devil never know you retired. Glennis Anderson opened the gates of hell for countless souls and facilitated their releasing themselves from it. In doing so, she gave them the resources to succeed. With professional help and through the recovery's own self-efficacy, thousands upon thousands have removed themselves from the shackles of addiction and moved to a life of freedom. If it's true that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, according to Martin Luther King Jr., then anyone who lightens the burden of another lightens the burden of the whole world. In a measurable way, Glennis Anderson has changed the world. The clinical director of Home and New Vision, Wendy Klinsky, attributes her own success to Anderson's help. Anderson helped Klinsky open Monroe's Engagement Center in 2018, which over the years has helped thousands of people. Engagement centers are short-term treatment centers, usually for a day or two, that get people off the street to take a hot shower, wash their clothes, sleep in a warm bed, and seek more permanent options for treatment. Anderson pioneered the engagement centers model that's been adopted across Michigan. All freestanding engagement centers in Michigan have Anderson's fingerprint upon them. Klinsky said, if it wasn't for the innovative work that Glennis Anderson has pioneered in Ann Arbor, I wouldn't have been successful in my career in Monroe. If Glennis hadn't chosen to advocate for those in need, it becomes the premise for the classic film It's a Wonderful Life, where an angel shows George Bailey what the world would have been like without him. What if Glennis Anderson had decided to make lots and lots of money without working for the welfare society? Those who went on to have families of their own in sobriety are grateful Anderson chose a magnanimous path. Some alumni from Home New Vision became business owners, nurses, florists, personal trainers, you name it. One notable alumni is an advocacy director at the state level and a director of constituent affairs at the U.S. Senate. Lives have been changed and destinies forever altered because of the efforts of one woman and a dedicated team of like-minded professionals. Today, Home New Vision is 85 to 90% staffed by those in long-term recovery. Anderson dedicated her life to proving that with enough TLC and patience, anybody can recover if they want it enough. Anderson knows well not to despise small beginnings. Home of New Vision began with one female client in 1996. The agency hadn't officially opened, but Anderson lost no time in welcoming the woman. According to Operations Director Demira Anderson, Glennis did not want to see this woman or this woman's chance for recovery to go away, so she invited her to stay on our couch until HMV could open officially. Friend and business partner Robbie Ranks joined Anderson in 2001. According to Ranks, that was when Home New Vision's growth began to snowball into an avalanche. However, it wasn't for years, several years, that we hit the turning point financially. Before that, there were times we were really struggling. We would sit around the table and decide who would get paid that week. If someone's mortgage or car payment was due, they would get paid and the rest of us would wait another week. To this day, there are two payrolls at Home New Vision on alternating Fridays. Still, there was a therapist who practically worked for free for a long time named Barbara Nordman. I think she eventually got all her pay, but Glennis named a conference room after her in the Ann Arbor office. That was the secret to her success, dedicated, hardworking people. Anderson and her dedicated team built Home and New Vision by hand, brick by brick. Reminiscing about the early days, Rank said, Glennis and I used to go to garage sales to find things to furnish the transitional homes because we didn't have the money to go out and buy things at the store. That just wasn't in the budget. Ranks laughed as she recalled an email she wrote out of frustration. She and Anderson had asked a favor and were disappointed with being refused. Ranks wrote, I can't believe they're not willing to do this. My God, you and I have moved so much furniture on our own, we should have two women in a truck tattooed to our asses. Anderson and her team of recovery pioneers bore a great deal on their shoulders. As they opened recovery house after recovery house, there were several residents who couldn't pay and had nowhere else to go. Ranks remembers, but we took anyone who had a willingness to be helped. If the business was in the red that month, Anderson somehow got HMV through the financial trouble. Putting people ahead of profits is Anderson's calling card. There are many competing programs that do not adhere to the People First policy, according to Ranks. There used to be and still are some treatment programs that are abusive. Anderson didn't want to be like those agencies and took an entirely different approach, one of honoring and respecting the individual and giving as many chances as needed within reason. Rank said these places would frequently abandon people in their recovery because of a relapse. Sometimes these agencies would put people out in the middle of the night. But Glynis didn't see the point in discharging people for relapse. Rather, she would increase their level of service. A big part of Glynis's legacy is meeting people where they're at, engagement over time, and creating a safe haven. She will always be there for people. Anderson's professional accomplishments include a broad range of academic accolades, prestigious awards, and speaking engagements. Recognizing the need for a safe, structured, and nurturing environment tailored to unique needs, she was inspired to create a program that would provide women and their families the tools to heal and to succeed. Despite being in early recovery and a single parent, Anderson pursued higher education with relentless determination, earning an associate degree in criminal justice, a bachelor's degree in human resource administration, a master's degree in social work, and a certified addiction counselor's license. And that was the foundation for a lifetime of service. Anderson was inspired by the words of former First Lady Betty Ford. Until we expand treatment opportunities for women and tailor programs to their specific needs, we will make little progress in helping addicted women recover from drug and alcohol dependency. Anderson's impact extends beyond Home and New Vision. She is a part-time lecturer at Eastern Michigan University's School of Social Work and has been a guest lecturer at the University of Michigan's Medical School. She is a board member for A Brighter Way, an advocacy group helping the formerly incarcerated reenter society and get work. Home of New Visions received the prestigious SAMHSA grant in 2008. The SAMHSA grant goes to only 8 agencies in the United States. This milestone solidified Anderson's role as a national leader in behavioral health. Anderson has left the organization in good shape by working with her successor over the years, and Heather Williams has been named the next CEO for Home and New Vision. Rank said, "I was glad she got the nod. She's the perfect candidate. I think she'll maintain the spirit Glynis infused into the agency. Thank you, Glynis, for all your sacrifice and hard work." Anderson found sobriety in 1990, and it helps to realize that everything in this article and many, many other stories that aren't in the article were done by one woman in recovery for a substance use disorder. Undoubtedly, there were dark days and dark nights between her sobriety date and her retirement that could have stopped her, but she kept going. Because of her tenaciousness and perseverance, Anderson's career is one for the history books. If you're reading this and you have a use disorder or mental health illness and life's become unmanageable, there is hope. You can recover too.